Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is humbled by the people who support this program by taking out subscriptions. My thanks to Paul L. Sesser, Brian Mossy, Nicholas Yaksich, and Sally Soriano. You'd like to join them? Visit the homepage at peterbcollins.com and follow the links right under my picture in the upper left-hand corner. Today we bring you an in-depth interview I've been angling for some time. And it turns out that my guest lives across the street and two houses down from my secret studio location. He is Frank Lind, the father of an infamous individual who was labeled the American Taliban, John Philip Walker Lind, now serving a 20-year sentence in federal prison. Today we bring you the story of John Philip Walker Lind, as told by his father, Frank.
All the world over, so easy to see. People everywhere just want to be free. Listen, people, listen, that's the way it should be. Deep in the valley, people got to be free.
My special guest on this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show is Frank Lind, L-I-N-D-H. He has the distinction and at sometimes the burden of being the father of detainee 001. Known to most Americans as John Walker Lind, we'll talk about his actual name as we get into the interview. And John Walker Lind is now in the 12th or 13th year of a 20-year federal prison sentence. He was dubbed the American Taliban, which, as we will discuss, is not accurate, and pilloried by the Bush administration, by the American media, in the hysteria following 9/11/2001. Frank Lind is an attorney. He is the lead counsel for a state government agency here in California. He teaches the law, and he joins me at my secret studio today. Frank, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning.
There is a lot to talk about here. And I want to give you an opportunity to tell about your son's odyssey, about his getting caught up in the post-9/11 skirmishes in Afghanistan. But I'd like to get a couple of things out first, if you don't mind. Did John have any role in the death of CIA agent Mike Johnny Spann? He was the first American killed in Afghanistan.
No, John was there. Both John and Mike Spann were there at the same place. And then there was this uprising where prisoners took arms from the Northern Alliance warlord, and there was just this chaotic situation. And John Spann, Mike Spann, was shot dead right there on the spot. And my son also was shot in the same melee, shot in the leg and fell to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly John, my John, had nothing to do with the death of Mike Spann. It was just an unfortunate situation both of these guys found themselves in.
Mm-hmm. Was John a traitor, as he has been widely labeled?
No, John is not a traitor. John's a normal American kid who went to Afghanistan at a time when we had good relations with the Taliban government, as they were at that time, and he never turned his back on his country or did anything that would constitute being a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
He was called a traitor, I understand that, but that's not a fair accusation.
There were accusations leveled that were inaccurate and very broad in general, but the impression many Americans have is that he was an active member of Al-Qaeda, that he had met Osama bin Laden in the summer of 2001 near Tora Bora.
Well, John, he's told us later, he never heard of Al-Qaeda. He didn't know what Al-Qaeda was. What John did, he was young and idealistic. He joined the army in Afghanistan, the National Army of Afghanistan, to help defend civilians. That was his agenda. And Osama bin Laden was there in Afghanistan at that time, and it was apparently quite easy to meet him. So John did meet him. John was very skeptical of bin Laden, didn't like him, could tell that he was not an authentic Muslim scholar. John is a devout Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So he did encounter bin Laden, but he certainly didn't join al-Qaeda. He didn't even know what al-Qaeda was.
Yeah, and this is what is so important. I've learned, Frank, that when you want to break down a sequence of events, that creating a timeline is extremely helpful. Because when you, for example, lay down a marker of where was John Philip Walker Lind on September 10th of 2001, and what did he know about al-Qaeda, about the relationship between Osama bin Laden and the attacks of 9/11 in the United States, and what did he know about the pivot that the United States made, where we ditched the Taliban-controlled central government of Afghanistan, aligned with the warlords whom we had fought against when they worked for the Soviet invaders in the 1980s, and we were aligned with Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen. And, you know, given the lack of advanced communications in Afghanistan, given that he was a recruit in the army, one can't expect that John knew all of the things that were available to Americans during that time frame.
Well, your question suggests it's a complicated situation, but here the simple facts here are that the American government in the spring of 2001 was very friendly with the Taliban government. President Bush was sending them tens of millions of dollars publicly.
$43 million for poppy eradication,
supposedly,
right?
Supposedly, yeah. And Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, announced this. This was all done quite openly. So we had friendly relations with the Taliban. It was clear, as the New York Times said in April of that year, that we were moving towards normalizing relations with the Taliban government. And it was right at that time, in the spring, when John went to Afghanistan to volunteer for their army to help defend civilians against these attacks from the Northern Alliance warlords. The Northern Alliance guys were backed by Russia. That's the situation that John walked into. And then 9/11 occurred. Now, your question says, where was John on the 10th of September, the day before these attacks? The answer to that is John was on the front lines in the Civil War. He had just been dispatched in early September to a province of Tahar. It's out in the northeastern frontier part of Afghanistan on the border of Tajikistan.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the most remote place in the world, from what I understand. And that's where he was. He was in an army in a civil war out there on that front line. Now, John, of course, did not know about the secret terrorist planning that bin Laden had, no more than the people in the United States. These terrorist plots were carried out with extreme secrecy and very, very devastating. But there's no suggestion that my son John knew anything about those attacks in advance. He was simply a soldier in the army of Afghanistan at that time.
So you, well, John was born in Washington, D.C. when you were working there. You came back to California, and he grew up here in Marin County, where we're speaking today. And you tell us that at the age of 12, he saw the Malcolm X movie, and it was his first introduction to Islam. How did it impress him, and how did it contrast with, you're a Roman Catholic, as I understand it, with the faith upbringing that you may or may not have provided?
Well, you're right. I am a Catholic, and John was raised in the Catholic Church. I took him to church on Sundays. And everything you said is correct. He, at age 12, he went to see the Spike Lee movie Malcolm X. And at the end, towards the end of his life, Malcolm X himself converted to sort of a traditional form of Islam. And there's a scene at the end of that movie that John found as a 12-year-old boy, found very powerful, and that's the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca. After all this happened to John, his case was prosecuted and so forth, he prepared an autobiographical statement for the court. And in that statement, he talked about this experience of seeing, as he described it, all these people perfectly humble and perfectly respectful praying together to God. And he found that very moving. Up until that time, like most American kids, John had never heard of Islam. He knew nothing about Islam. Mm-hmm. And so his interest was piqued, and he began to study it on his own. He was an early user of the internet. and began researching everything he could find about the religion of Islam starting at age 12. He's got a really inquisitive mind.
And so as a Catholic, did he receive First Communion? Was he, what do we call it?
He's baptized.
Baptized and then the other
First
one.
Communion,
confirmation.
He never got as far as confirmation because by then this Islamic thing had kicked off for him. Mm-hmm.
Now, was he rejecting Catholicism or was he just kind of not interested in it and Islam sung to him?
In a way, you'd have to ask John that question, but I think the answer is yes. He was moving away from Catholicism and all of the complexity that goes along with it. You know, the Catholic religion has a lot of complex doctrines and things. John was attracted to Islam, I think, because of its simplicity. I mean, in Islam, there's no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Jesus is a prophet as well to the Muslim people. All the Old Testament prophets are considered prophets, but the Islamic religion does not have the centuries of layered-on beliefs that the Roman Catholic Church has adopted. Mm-hmm. And so John, I think, was definitely attracted by the simplicity of Islam. And I deeply respect his decision. I respect Islam. It's from my perspective as a Catholic, Islam is sort of a variation on my own religion. That's how I view it.
Well, it's been about 8 years, but maybe even a little longer. I interviewed the imam in Mill Valley for the public radio show Interfaith Voices. And I was touched because he's a very approachable guy. He runs a motel with an Indian restaurant in front of it. And he vouched for John in every way. He said that he was extremely sincere. He was devoted. He was a gentle person and quite thoughtful and also smart, not simply a kind of passive reciter of mumbo-jumbo, but somebody who really embraced this religious experience.
Yeah, that's John. He embraced the spirituality of it, but also the intellectual aspects. Islam has a great tradition of intellectual knowledge and pursuit of knowledge, and so that's an aspect also that appealed to John. And yes, the imam actually submitted a letter to the court when John was brought back to the United States, in which he described John as among the most devout converts he had ever known to the Islamic religion, referred to him as a very good person.
Mm-hmm. So John went to Yemen to study Arabic and the Quran.
Yes, John went to the Mill Valley Mosque at age 16 and converted to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know, neither Marilyn, his mom, nor I knew in advance that John was planning this, but once we learned that he had, we were fine with it. We support John's conversion. It was good for him. It was like he found his own path. And then almost immediately he became interested in going overseas to learn Arabic. It's absolutely required in the Islamic religion that you become fluent in Arabic and read the Quran itself in the original Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
Much like in my own tradition in the Catholic Church in the old days, to be an educated person, you had to learn Latin. You learned the Latin language and became fluent in Latin. I have an uncle who's a theologian, a Catholic priest, former priest now, who studied in Rome and did all his studies in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that same tradition in Islam. You must learn Arabic, the original language of the Quran. So John did his research, found out that Yemen on the Saudi Peninsula is really the best place to study classical Arabic without the Arabic spoken there has less colloquialisms than many other Arabic-speaking countries. So if you want to learn the original sort of classical Arabic, that's the place to go.
Once again, to put it on a timeline, he first went to Sana'a, Yemen in 1998. Most Americans had never heard of Yemen until the bombing of the Kohl in the fall of 2000. And I think it's, again, important to note that because with the emergence of al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, the use of drone strikes, including those that killed American citizens, Alaki and his son, many Americans are now vaguely aware of Yemen as a kind of failed state with a civil war that has been running on and off and unstable leadership there. So what was your impression of Yemen when John said, hey, I'm going to Sana'a, Dad?
Mom and Dad, I'm going to Yemen. Well, at the time John went, things in Yemen were much more peaceful. None of this turmoil that you're describing had really gone on yet. So we didn't have those kind of concerns. I will say, though, I'm John's father, and I think fathers are more what's the word, more liberal about letting their young sons, especially sons, go off and explore the world.
So it's kind of an outward bound thing, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. And education abroad is a wonderful thing. This was true education both culturally as well as the language and the religion. So I was quite enthusiastic about it. But I have to tell you that John's mother was less so. I mean, she was more concerned, more worried. It's natural for a mother, I think, to have more trepidation. John was only 17 years old when we took him to the airport to get on that plane to Sana'a. But it was clear that his heart was set on it. He knew what he wanted. He wanted to go study Arabic in its original context, and that's what he did. He was quite happy once he got to Yemen. It's very challenging. It's a difficult language. It's a Semitic language. It's not Indo-European. It bears no relationship to our English language. Very challenging language to study. But he loved it. He thrived there and really enjoyed the study.
Don't want to pry too much, but you and Marilyn divorced at one point. When was that, and how did John respond to it?
Well, we separated really about the time John went to Yemen and have divorced since then, and I'm remarried now. So how did John respond? All three of our kids, John is the middle of three children. I think they all found it difficult to accept that Mama and Papa were divorcing. But we've always stayed close, and John's mother and I have remained close, especially with the difficulty we've been through with his case. So it's not a bitter divorce, and the kids have stayed close to both of us. John was already liberated as a young adult by the time that happened, but Naomi, our daughter, was much younger. She was only about 11. And she grew up in joint custody with me and Marilyn, went back and forth between our two homes. So we've made the best of it. The kids have made the best of it. Divorce is a painful thing for a family.
Yeah. And just briefly, how did the other siblings deal with the notoriety that John, was subject to? It's not something you seek. Do they feel invisible in terms of, the public perception of your family?
Well, I'll say this. I think this, what we went through as a family was horrific. The president, all the top members of his cabinet went on television repeatedly, and it was in all the newspapers and magazines as well. They were telling the American people that John Lind was an Al-Qaeda fighter, was a traitor to the United States. And even went so far, John Ashcroft went so far as to suggest that John somehow had been behind or perpetrated or involved in the 9/11 attacks themselves. It was unbelievable what they said about John, and really painful for all of us. Now, John's mother and I had the sort of the parental mama bear, papa bear instinct to rise up and defend John. These were false allegations, and we knew they were false, and so our adrenaline kicked in. But I have to say, I think for Connell and Naomi, Connell is John's older brother, and Naomi is John's younger sister. I think for them it was very traumatic. And Naomi told me last year, we were talking about all this, she said it was the most difficult thing she's ever been through. Mm-hmm. It was very, very difficult to see her brother, who she loves, criticized and castigated like this by the top powerful leaders of our country and in all of the media outlets. I mean, there was no exception. All the big New York Times and CBS News and ABC, there was no single media outlet that did not refer to John as a traitor or as a terrorist or Al-Qaeda fighter. It was very difficult.
So then in 2000, in September, John notified you that he was going to shift to Pakistan to continue his studies of Arabic and the Quran.
November of 2000. Yeah, I think you said September. So my timeline, it's November.
Okay.
But yes, he said he was... Well, November is when he went. Maybe you're right that September is when we first began the dialogue about that. I'm sorry, Peter.
I'm working from your deposition, counselor.
All right. Well, and I have to admit...
And let me just say...
So it was the fall of 2000, certainly, that John... his visa expired. His student visa in Yemen came to its end. And it was time to leave Yemen, and his choices were come home or go to another country. And John definitely did not want to come home because he didn't want to interrupt his study, especially his language study. So he convinced me, and I agreed with this proposition, that he would go to Pakistan, and in Pakistan enroll in a madrasa, a kind of like a seminary, but a school for memorization of the Quran. And that's what he did. That was his plan, and that's what he did. He got to Pakistan. He had made a connection with a guy from Pakistan here in the Bay Area before he went to Yemen. So he renewed that relationship and went to Pakistan, toured around the country, and viewed several of these different madrasas before he selected the one that he then went to. Mm-hmm. So then beginning in late 2000, John was enrolled as full-time as a student at this madrasa, engaged in this very old traditional form of scholarship in Islam, which is where they memorize the entire Quran from start to finish.
And I would suspect that John was pretty immersed in all this. And as we had the election and the cliffhanger of 2000 and the Supreme Court deciding that Bush would be the next president,
all that.
Yeah, he was probably unaware of all that.
Well, John was always in touch with us. I mean, he wasn't completely oblivious, but you're right. He was definitely absorbed mm-hmm. in his studies. He was really immersed in the culture, immersed in the language, and immersed in the study of Islam. He really, as you might say, he went native. You know, he was mm-hmm. really interested in Islamic culture, and he loved it. But he always stayed in contact with us, with his family, by email.
Mm-hmm.
He would go to internet cafes, log on, and send us emails. And I have a lot of great, funny emails from John. He has a great sense of humor about his studies and his observations of daily life there and so forth. And then in turn, we would keep him informed about family news, things going on here. We have a big, great big extended family. So he was kept apprised of what was going on, and he had some general sense, I think, of the events you're describing in the, you know, the political world, the mm-hmm. election of President Bush and so forth. But those things were not of much interest to John. He really was absorbed in his studies.
Yeah. So then in the spring of 2001, toward the end of April, you and Marilyn got an email saying that John was going to escape the heat of Pakistan and go to the mountains. Did he specify he was going into Afghanistan, or was it just kind of vague, I'm going to go to the mountains?
It was just the vague part. He never mentioned Afghanistan to me or Marilyn, and honestly, it never occurred to us that that's where he was thinking of going. What he said was, I plan to go into the mountains, as you said. I plan to go into the mountains for the summer to get away from the heat, the humid heat in Pakistan. And John, I have to say, back in Washington, D.C., when he was a kid, he really did not tolerate heat and humidity very well. In mm-hmm. fact, he did much better when we moved here to California, where we don't have that kind of humidity.
I embrace that. I grew up in the Midwest. I can't stand Washington because of that humidity. And I thrive in mild and low humidity California.
We love this Mediterranean climate. So anyway, John's emails made sense to us. We accepted them, but he was actually not being completely forthright.
Mm-hmm.
His intention from the moment he left the madrasa was to go into Afghanistan to volunteer for the army because he had heard these stories about horrific human rights violations that were committed by the Northern Alliance warlords against civilians, rape of women, killing of prisoners, this kind of thing. And the State Department, the United States Department of State, has these human rights reports that are issued every year. And these reports document everything John had heard. There were indeed terrible human rights violations being carried out in connection with this ongoing civil war between the Northern Alliance warlords and the Taliban government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all know as well that the Taliban government had a terrible, terrible human rights record. But John, I think, viewed this through the prism of a Muslim who saw the Taliban as sort of the good guys in this situation and the Northern Alliance as the bad guys.
Did he ever speak out against the Taliban's oppression of women?
No. Mind you, John was only in Afghanistan for a period of several months before 9/11 mm-hmm. and the American invasion and then these events that led eventually to his rescue. He was very nearly killed several times in Afghanistan, so he didn't have the kind of time you're suggesting to sort of pause and look at things. He also didn't have exposure to civilian life in Afghanistan. He went into Afghanistan, went directly to a military training camp, and got trained as an infantry soldier, and then was dispatched to the front line as a soldier. So mm-hmm. John never had the luxury of sort of touring around Afghanistan to see how life was for ordinary people.
Did you ever have second thoughts about at any stage here where John, you know, basically went off on his own and didn't tell you what he was doing? Do you ever feel that at some point you should have tried to rein him in or persuade him not to take risks? Or was it simply the natural evolution of a child separating from his parents and striking out on his own?
Well, I certainly regret that John went to Afghanistan. I wish he hadn't done that. And I know the reason he didn't tell me that he was going was I would have forbidden him. I would have said, no, John, that's even if there is a fight going on there, and even if there's a good guy and a bad guy, and you want to help the good guy, what you think is the good guy. That's not our fight. The civil war in Afghanistan had been going on ever since the Soviets had withdrawn back in the 80s. Don't go there, I would have told him. And he didn't tell me. I mean, I think it's kind of obvious why. he didn't want me to tell him no. So that's why he was a little bit not forthcoming in that one respect where he said, I'm going to the mountains for the summer. Didn't tell me or his mom that he was really going to Afghanistan to place himself in harm's way. I would never have agreed to that. But these other steps, the things that he did, I absolutely have no regret about these. Mm-hmm. This is John pursuing his love of Islam and his study of Islam. He was really immersing himself in the culture of these countries. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great thing for a young American to expose himself, I think, and become fluent in the language and so forth.
Has he ever expressed regret that he went to Afghanistan?
Not regret. He did in his statement at the court when he did a plea bargain. He agreed to this 20-year sentence. And by the way, the government did drop in the plea bargain all of the charges related to 9/11, to Al-Qaeda, to terrorism. These were all deliberately, I think, trumped up and false charges. And they were all dropped quite remarkably in the plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
But in return, John had to accept a 20-year sentence. And then he got to make his one and only court appearance, a court statement. And he said that if I had known then what I know now about the Taliban, I would not have gone to help them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as close as he's come to a statement of regret. But I do think as well, I have to be honest, as John looks back on the situation pre-9/11, before all that, he still thinks the Taliban were the good guys relative to the Northern Alliance warlords who were the bad guys. And there's no doubt the Northern Alliance warlords were authentic bad guys and the things they were doing were really terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So John still, I think, in his heart feels that he was trying to help, trying to do the right thing for civilians, to defend innocent civilians.
So the summer of 2001, John volunteers to join the Afghan army and they send him to a kind of training camp, a boot camp, near Tora Bora. Is that right?
Actually, I'm not sure of the location, but it's somewhere in central Afghanistan. Yes, there is a military and infantry training camp. The New York Times ran a series of articles about this camp after the invasion when the Americans were able to go in and find it. And they confirmed, the articles and the American intelligence confirmed that the training camp where John was just that. It was just a military training camp. Now, there were other places in Afghanistan where Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization conducted secret training of the terrorists who perpetrated these attacks.
Well, then let me withdraw Tora Bora. I don't want to mislead our listeners. It's not in the narrative. And by the way, I'm going to link to a lengthy article that you wrote for The Guardian in Britain that was published in 2011. And listeners can click on that in the show file at peterbcollins.com. So wherever the location was, this was an Afghan government military camp where Osama bin Laden had been a presence since we invited him to Afghanistan to displace the Soviets about 1985. So he had been in and out of Afghanistan and was a kind of prominent visitor and a friend of the Taliban government.
He was certainly a friend of the Taliban government, and he was in Afghanistan as a guest of the Taliban government. But your question kind of omits something really important, which was that the United States government was after Osama bin Laden ever since the embassy bombings in Africa. And there was no doubt in the minds of the American intelligence community since 1998 that Osama bin Laden was a terrorist who was bent on striking against American targets. He was anything but a benign guy. He was one of the most wanted men in the world, even before 9/11. However, John, this young idealistic kid from Marin County, didn't really know any of that. All he knew was that Osama bin Laden was a sort of a noted figure, whatever, in Afghanistan among the soldiers who were there, the Mujahideen, these young volunteers. And when he met bin Laden, that's where John saw something wrong. In July of 2001, bin Laden came to this camp where John was. Later, the CIA said it was impossible for Americans to get anywhere near Osama bin Laden, and John proves that that was not true. I mean, he's a young American kid, at that point, 19 years old, 20 years old, he's meeting Osama bin Laden in the summer of 2001. So how hard was it really to get close to that man? Kind of begs that question. But anyway, John clearly saw that he was, I would use the word, a phony. John is an authentic Muslim. He believes in Islam. He believes in the precepts of Islam. They're not that different from Christianity. They would never kill an innocent civilian, for example. And a Muslim would never commit suicide. These are very basic principles that are important to John. And when he met bin Laden, he sensed that there was something about him that was false, that he was not authentic. He was certainly not a scholar. And John just thought he was a creepy guy and then mm-hmm. thought no more about it.
And was his wealth known, and was that a source of the power that he enjoyed?
Well, he's from a wealthy family. His father was a big construction magnate in Saudi Arabia. He's from Yemen, bin Laden's father, and he's very wealthy. He provided a lot of money to the Taliban to actually fund these military training camps. So he wasn't just a guest of the Taliban. He kind of paid his way.
He was the patron.
He was a bit of a patron to a rather poor country, Afghanistan. So were we, by the way. I mean, as I say, the United States was giving the same Taliban government during President Bush's time in 2001, was sending tens of millions of dollars to the same Taliban government. But yes, bin Laden was a financial supporter of the Taliban. He sort of bought his custody there. Mm-hmm. In return, though, then he was carrying out these secret plans to attack the United States, and we all know about 9/11.
So as you referenced earlier, on September 10th, John was in northeast Afghanistan on the border with Tajikistan and had no knowledge of bin Laden's involvement, didn't know what al-Qaeda was. We didn't know what al-Qaeda was. It hadn't been described to us until September 12th. And I've always felt that was a little weird that, you know, they instantly could identify the source of these attacks and they exposed this group that was known to our intelligence community but not widely known to the American public. In any event, we fast forward to late November, and there is a shift because U.S. agents have arrived in Afghanistan. These are the advanced CIA fellows, including Johnny Mike Spann. Mike is the name he used. Johnny was, I guess, his given name. And so then we have this shift in alliances where the warlords are now working for the United States. The Taliban becomes the enemy. And this shift takes place without, I would imagine, John knowing anything about it. What does he recollect, if anything, about the geopolitical changes as he was, caught up as a volunteer in the Afghan army?
Well, two things really happened that fall. First is, as you've already said, Peter, the United States did a complete 180. The guys who had been our enemy became our friend. The guys who had been our friend became our enemy. This is the result of 9/11. We decided to turn around and invade Afghanistan, align ourselves with the Northern Alliance to try to oust the Taliban government. I think John was probably aware of that because he was under the bombs that the Americans were dropping. The other thing, though, that happened in the United States policy was that this is all documented. The United States, when it invaded Afghanistan, declared that it would not honor the Geneva Conventions governing the treatment of prisoners of war. It's a very, very important decision. Now, Afghanistan is a signatory to the Geneva Conventions. The United States, of course, is a signatory to those conventions. So why did we do that? What was behind that decision? I can't speculate. But it did have a huge impact because the Northern Alliance warlords that we chummed up with had a longstanding, notorious record for killing, torturing, maiming, and killing prisoners of war. It was really bad news. They don't take prisoners, is another way to put it. Mm-hmm. If you fell into the hands of a Northern Alliance soldier, and there are photographs of this in the New York Times from that fall, from November of 2001, they castrate the soldier and then kill him. That's what they do when they find prisoners. They don't put them in nice prison camps and turn them back over to their governments in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. And the American government made a conscious choice not to to honor the Geneva Conventions, and it gave license to those warlords to commit murder on a huge scale of prisoners. So John was very lucky to survive this. He fell into the hands of a murderous warlord. He's very fortunate to have survived. Thousands of prisoners of, like John, were killed by the warlords in the period November, December 2001. This is all documented in an extensive story in Newsweek, cover story in Newsweek magazine. The New York Times covered it. These are not disputed facts.
Mm-hmm. So, Frank, you write, the front lines, the front between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance in Takhar, where John was stationed, quickly dissolved after the American bombing commenced. Taliban troops fled in panicked retreat to Kunduz. They marched without stop for 2 days, covering a distance of 50 miles of harsh desert terrain. The conditions were hellish. The Northern Alliance troops killed all stragglers who fell behind and, as you mentioned, often castrating them before killing them. And so these Taliban, these soldiers of the Afghan army of the Taliban government, we just described the shift in alliances, wanted to surrender. But you just described that the warlords took no prisoners, and they brutally handled those who they dispatched. And so this is a classic pickle situation where there are no good choices. So describe the scene at this school. It's a pink building that had been built by the Soviets that shows up in some of the coverage. And how John and his fellow troops tried to hunker down there.
Okay, if I can, Peter, I'd like to start with Kunduz, where they began. Mm-hmm. They retreated to Kunduz. There's a cable that was sent to the Department of Defense and to the CIA from the American consulate there in Kunduz, and it said, what should we do about these prisoners? They want to surrender to someone who won't kill them. And Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and the others just made no response. And it really documents in a government document what I'm talking about here, that the dilemma of the prisoners who could not surrender. So then what happened was the local Taliban commander made a deal with the Northern Alliance warlord in that area named General Dostum. He was just in today's paper. Dostum is still out there in Afghanistan. He's a notorious human rights violator. Everyone pretty much considers him to be a war criminal. Literally in today's New York Times, it uses that term. And Dostum took money from the Taliban guy and said, okay, I will let your there were about 200 to 300 of these Taliban soldiers. You surrender your weapons, and I'll let you pass through my territory west of Kunduz, and you can pass through going to the west to Herat in the western part of Afghanistan. And these soldiers, 300 of them, thought, well, this is our way out. We will be able to kind of quietly leave Afghanistan by that route. Well, Dostum is a bad guy, and he diverted. He took the money, and then he broke the deal, and he diverted the trucks containing these 300 soldiers into a big fortress that he controlled outside the city of Mazar-e-Sharif. It's an ancient, old, you know, hundreds of year old fortress. Inside, it's walled, a big walled fortress. I picture it like the Alamo, but about 10 times bigger inside. Bigger than several football fields. And in the fortress, there's a building. There's the Soviet-built classroom building called the Pink Building, and all these 300 guys were shoved down into the basement of that building. This is in late November 2001. And the next morning, they were let out of the basement one at a time. Their arms were tied at the elbows with ropes. They were struck by, John himself was pulled out of the basement, was struck in the head by a rifle butt by one of Dostum's soldiers. And they were starting to interrogate them. There were no American soldiers there in the fortress that day, but there were these two CIA men, Mike Spann and another guy named Dave Tyson. They were there with Dostum's troops, not with American troops, but with Dostum's troops, trying to interrogate the prisoners. John was one of the first that they pulled out to interrogate, and they seemed to have some sense. They asked him if he was Irish, and they seemed to have some sense that he might not be that he might be English speaking. But John refused to answer. He was afraid. He was in fear of his life, for good reason, because this Dostum is really a bad guy. So John thought, if I say a word, there's a good chance they'll single me out to kill me. My hope is not good here, but my only hope is to stay with the 300, and maybe by some miracle, Dostum will let us continue on our journey to Herat. So John didn't speak, but Spann and Tyson tried to threaten him to speak, and they said, you'll spend the rest of your short fucking life here, excuse my language, if you don't talk to us. They're threatening to kill him. So again, John felt very threatened and very unsafe. So he didn't speak. And they put him back in the crowd out there in this field. And then moments later, the few remaining Taliban prisoners that were being let out of the basement grabbed weapons from Dostum's troops. And then Dostum's troops went into a panic and began to gun down all the 300 Taliban prisoners in the courtyard, most of them, like John, with their arms tied behind their backs. And it's at that moment, with this spray of gunfire, that Mike Spann got killed. Mm-hmm. Single bullet wound to the head killed him. John, in the same very moment, got shot in the leg with an AK-47 bullet. He's very fortunate, John is, that that bullet didn't penetrate an artery or break his leg. And he fell to the ground injured. And just laid there pretending to be dead while this massacre then transpired.
Hmm. And then he crawled back into the building?
Yeah, later that night, some of the Taliban guys survived and went, you know, sought shelter down in the basement of the building. And at night, under cover of darkness, they came out and looked around. There were dozens and dozens, scores of dead soldiers, Taliban soldiers, still with their arms tied behind their backs, all over this field. And they looked among the carcasses to find anyone who was alive. And John was there. John was alive. And they mm-hmm. took him, helped him back down into that basement.
And then there's another sequence, I guess, the following day, where grenades were dropped into that building, and then they flooded the Pink Classroom building?
Yeah, it actually took a whole week from Sunday to Friday.
Okay.
And at the beginning part of the week, there were some of these Taliban guys were going to fight to death. They fought to the death. They were going to fight their way out of that fortress. John was not among those. John was hunkered down in the basement. But there's a group of these Taliban soldiers that once they got those weapons, they put up a fight for several days. At that point, they did bring in American and British special forces. And by Tuesday, they had killed all the fighters. And now here they are. There's a whole group of these Taliban soldiers down in the basement of that building. And they wanted to surrender. But here again, you see, Dostum take no prisoners. So Dostum, with help at this point by the Americans, began doing all these things to try to kill the prisoners in the basement. Initially, they brought in an American bomber and dropped a 500-pound bomb that would have completely obliterated the Pink Building and killed everyone inside, but it was misdirected and hit the wall of the fortress instead of the building inside the fortress, and it killed some of Dostum's troops. So they said, no, no more bombs. We're going to find other ways. So they dropped, as you said, they dropped grenades down into the basement. They used flamethrowers and dropped gasoline down and set it on fire. Many of these guys burned to death in that basement. Others were killed with shrapnel. And then at the end of the week, they flooded the basement with water from an irrigation ditch to try to drown the men in the basement. And John survived all that, and along with 85 other guys. There were 86 survivors at the end of that week who finally, at the end of the week, were allowed out of the basement to surrender peacefully.
And just coming back to Mike Spann for a minute, because it is crucial, because allegations were made linking John to his death. There's a journalist there for the British newspaper The Guardian, Luke Harding, and he wrote that, coming back to this scene we were talking about a minute ago, the prisoners grabbed the guards' weapons, and it was then that Spann did a Rambo. As the remaining guards ran away, Spann flung himself to the ground and began raking the courtyard and its prisoners with automatic fire. Five or six prisoners jumped on him, and he disappeared beneath a heap of bodies. So, just to be very clear, there is no way whatsoever that John could have been involved in the death of Spann, because he was bound with his arms behind him and unarmed at that time. Is that correct?
And shot. He was laying on the ground with a bullet in his leg. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's all correct.
Yeah.
And then I did see there were some sensational reports about how Mike Spann died. Mike Spann's a hero. Let me just say that. Mike Spann's a good man who did what he thought was right for his country. He died and left a widow and little children behind. It's a sad, sad story. But John Lind is not his murderer, had nothing to do with that. This was alleged, though, by the government initially. John Ashcroft alleged that my John had something to do with Mike Spann's death. But for all the reasons you've said, it's very, very clear that John Lind has no involvement in that death. It's just a tragedy.
So at the end of this brutal week, Saturday, December 1st, the Red Cross arrives at this fortress and extracts the survivors. How did they win access? How did the Red Cross get invited there? Did the U.S. bring them in? Did Dostum relent? Exactly how did that occur?
Well, this uprising and massacre in the fortress attracted a lot of attention from the media. And so that entire week, I actually remember following this story. I had no idea that John was in Afghanistan, much less that he was in this place. But this uprising and massacre was widely covered here in the media and in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
So on the premises there on Friday, was these poor guys were let out of that basement, there were lots of TV crews, media crews from all over the world, and the Red Cross. So the Americans at some point midweek, and Luke Harding, the journalist you just quoted, was also there from The Guardian. So the Americans, I guess, at some point, and the British Special Forces at some point, had allowed journalists to come in. And there's just tremendous amount of video coverage of the battle itself inside the fortress, taken from the walls up above looking down into the fortress. So there was, you know, it was not a situation where Dostum had these guys to himself. There's no doubt in John's mind that if Dostum had his way, he would have killed all 86 of those survivors as they came out of the basement. But the presence of the media and the presence of the Red Cross and the presence of American troops made it impossible for Dostum to carry out a massacre at that point.
So on December 1st, John is still injured with a bullet in the leg, and he is taken in an open bed truck at night, and it's cold. He's taken to a hospital, a prison hospital at Sherbergen. And this is when a CNN reporter, Robert Pelton, basically forced himself on John. John declined to be interviewed, but because he was immobilized and wounded, he really couldn't physically prevent it.
Yeah, it was a terrible situation for John, and thank God he did survive, and thank God he got some good military, some good medical care from the military there. Really, that was a great thing. But he was severely wounded at that point. He had shrapnel wounds, the bullet wound. He had suffered hypothermia. Remember, they were standing in cold water for a full day before they're let out into the winter. It's wintertime in Afghanistan, and you're soaking wet in the cold. So he had hypothermia and all these wounds. And also, they hadn't eaten for that entire week. They had no food and no drink for a week. They were starving and thirsty. So John was actually close to death at that point. And then this cameraman comes in, this interviewer, and says, we could help you. And John says, if you want, somehow John had the presence of mind. And he says, if you want to help me, turn off the camera and don't interview me. He said it, and his saying that is actually on the camera. Please don't interview me. Turn off the camera. But the journalist does not do the right thing. He just keeps the camera going and questioning John in this condition while the medic administers morphine. And the morphine was very soothing to John, and then he relaxed and began talking. And so the entire interview then was carried out against John's wishes and while John is being administered morphine.
Mm-hmm.
The interview became an absolute sensation here in the United States because it was depicted as if he was an Al-Qaeda terrorist and a traitor to the United States. But in fact, if you listen to it objectively, you'll hear John tell his whole story. And all his whole story is, I was a soldier in the Army of Afghanistan, and now I've been through this series of ordeals because they wouldn't take prisoners. And he was very courageous and very lucky to have survived what he went through.
And based on that scene, Newsweek magazine dubbed John Philip Walker Lind, who at that point was being called John Walker. Right.
Yeah, even President George Walker Bush kept calling my son John Walker. I don't know how that mistake came up. John's middle name is Walker. All my kids have Walker as a middle name.
Mm-hmm.
It's John Philip Walker Lind.
Yeah.
For a while, they called him John Walker. President Bush used to refer to him that way. But eventually, they got the name straight. But yes, he was dubbed the American Taliban. And more importantly, I think more seriously, he was called Al-Qaeda fighter by President Bush, and not just once, but repeatedly.
Well, there is a new usage of the term American Taliban, and I just saw the new Jeremy Scahill documentary called Dirty Wars, and it focuses on the Joint Special Operations Command, the JSOC raiding teams that conduct night raids in Afghanistan, and there are many of those American soldiers who are bearded. And so locals have taken to referring to them as American Taliban.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I had not heard that. But John is the original so-called American Taliban. He was, as you said at the beginning of this interview, he was also labeled in this entire war on terror, as President Bush called it, John Lind is detainee 001 in the Pentagon's listing of detainees.
Mm-hmm.
It's so ironic that the first detainee is an American citizen.
Well, and this really brings into focus the brutal treatment that John received from Americans who knew that he was an American citizen. And the detention of him in a shipping container with no heat, and the nights are very cold there in
wintertime. Well, it's worse than that, Peter, if I can interrupt you.
Please, go ahead.
Here's what happened. And John's lawyers got a copy of this letter from Donald Rumsfeld's files where he said, take the gloves off. He used that expression, take the gloves off in your interrogation of this young American after he was discovered among the survivors of the massacre. So at that point, John passed from Dostum's custody into the custody of the Americans. And that's when we learned that John was alive and in Afghanistan and so forth. And his mom and I, all of us in the family, we thought, oh, thank God, John's he's in safe hands now. He's in the hands of his own people now, the Americans. They'll take care of him. But we were wrong. They took John to a base in southern Afghanistan. They flew him down a Marine Corps base called Camp Rhino. And they stripped John naked in the nighttime and bound him, his hands and his feet, with these plastic restraints, extremely tight, extremely painful. He's already suffered hypothermia and wounds and starvation.
And he's still packing the bullet in his leg.
The bullet is in his leg, and a doctor later described it as a festering wound. And they took him in that condition, completely naked, and put him in a shipping container with no blanket or anything, and left him in there for 2 days and two nights, while Marines, young Marines, on the outside of the shipping container shouted epitaphs and threatened to kill him inside. And he was in there trembling uncontrollably from the cold and the wounds. There was absolutely no justification for this treatment. John had nothing to hide, number one. Number two, he was perfectly willing to talk to the Americans and tell them everything he had known, everything he had seen. This was just wanton abuse by the American soldiers there at Camp Rhino. But it was endorsed directly by Secretary Rumsfeld.
You wrote, I'm a lawyer, trained in the law, with more than 25 years of experience. Never have I seen or read about a case in which a person accused of a crime was so conspicuously deprived of what we call, and you're explaining this to a British audience, the presumption of innocence. On the contrary, my son was presumed guilty, not only by government officials, but by the entire mainstream journalism and media establishment in America. It was and still is widely reported in America that John Lind is a terrorist who fought against the U.S. And even if that were true, Frank, there's no justification to treat him that way. And likewise, there is no justification for the Gitmo and Abu Ghraib treatment that Donald Rumsfeld also personally authorized. And he wrote memos, urging people to be held in stress positions or made to stand longer. He was micromanaging the inhumane treatment of many of America's detainees.
Well, some of what you said is of a political nature, and I won't comment on that, but I will say this, that John is an innocent person that they knew was innocent. There was no doubt in Secretary Rumsfeld's mind that John Lind was what he was. He was just a kid fighting, volunteering to be in the army of Afghanistan, and they still treated him that way with no probable cause, no suspicion of any kind. Now, some of these other ones you refer to, they may be people that they really did have some. I'm not justifying torture, but they may be people that the United States had some justification for thinking were involved with terrorism or things of that nature. But in John's case, and really in the case of hundreds and hundreds of these young Muslims picked up in Afghanistan, we had no suspicion that they were involved with any sort of criminal activity or terrorism. And I think the record has kind of proven that the bulk of the men taken to Guantanamo, for example, turned out not to be terrorists at all. They were put through severe abuse, but after all that, it turned out they really were, well, they were what they were, which was just soldiers in an army, and eventually most of them were sent home.
Well, a lot of them weren't soldiers. There were a lot of people who were doing community service type work, who had, as you know, good Muslims, had volunteered to go to Afghanistan. There were people who simply were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and scores were settled, bounties were paid. So you're correct. There are 773 people who've been held at Guantanamo at some time, and over 600 of them were released without any charge related to terrorism.
You may recall Secretary Rumsfeld, again, we keep coming back to him, he used to say they're the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
All those guys, those 700-some guys, those are the worst of the worst. Well, yeah. He had a proclivity for making those kind of statements, but now we know history has proved that the bulk of them were not terrorists at all. And my point about John is that he was an innocent. He was a young, idealistic kid. And Secretary Rumsfeld deliberately did this to him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This was not someone they thought might be a terrorist who might know something about terrorism, and if we treat him this way, maybe we will learn something useful. It wasn't that at all.
So now let's talk about your perspective from here in California. Tell us how you first found out that it was John who was in American custody and being labeled the American Taliban.
Well, I'll never forget it. It was a Saturday night. I just came out of the movies in Fairfax, Marin County, Fairfax. We saw the movie, I can't remember it now. It won't matter. And I had a cell phone, and I turned it back on. I had it off during the film, and it was a message from Marilyn, my ex-wife, who lived right nearby. She said, come right away, come right away. Well, my cousin had spotted a story on MSNBC on the website, and it was partly Newsweek and MSNBC at that time, about a young American that was discovered among the survivors of that uprising and massacre that we were talking about, which I had been following in the newspaper. So I went over to her house immediately and walked in, and there was this grainy photograph of the young American. They didn't have his name at that point, but instantly I could see, and Marilyn could too, that it was John. He looked exactly, if you don't mind my saying this, I had an identical twin brother. And when we were in our 20s, we looked a lot like John was looking at that point, and he looked just like my twin brother. I just knew, and you know how you can recognize family.
Sure.
It was John. They had a few sketchy facts. They said he had been born in Washington, D.C., which was true of John, in 1981, that he had grown up in California, and then there was the photograph. So we realized, oh, my God, it's John. He's in Afghanistan, and he's just survived this incredible ordeal, this massacre. What condition is he in? Well, it reported that he had been wounded, but we really didn't know what condition he was in. So we immediately, the next morning, Sunday morning, I called a lawyer that I knew in San Francisco, a great trial lawyer named James Brosnahan, asked if he would help, and he said, yes, I'll take the case. And then immediately he began making inquiries on John's behalf on Monday, the 3rd of December. He sent a letter, wonderful letter, to Secretary Rumsfeld, Attorney General Ashcroft, the Director of Intelligence at the Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, the General Counsel of the Defense Department, and to Colin Powell, the Secretary of State. And it said, I represent John Walker Lind. I'm his lawyer. His parents and I request a safe passage to visit their son. And he got no response to that letter, but the government proceeded then to hold John in military custody for 54 days before they finally allowed us to have access when they brought him back to Northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And so how helpless did you feel during that time? It just has to be excruciating.
It was a terrible feeling, Peter. Yes, we felt very helpless and completely overwhelmed, not just by the media coverage, but by the way our government was acting. It was as if, and I'm an American citizen, I've worked for the American government myself for much of my life, it was as if our son was in the custody of an enemy government. That's how it felt, as if the Soviet Union had taken our son. It was so bad. They would give us no information whatsoever. Later we learned these facts about the mistreatment that he was put through and so forth. But it was like an alien government. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, in fairness, this was after 9/11. 9/11 was a terrible, terrible event in our country. Hard to overstate how terrible it was. And I think the officials of our government were just reacting in a kind of visceral manner. I don't know. I can't explain it. But they acted towards my family as if they were an alien enemy government. And it was absolutely overwhelming. and the media went right along with it. The media coverage of John's case was, you know, completely one-sided, hysterical, distorted. It was just overwhelming.
Did Brosnahan send any investigators to Afghanistan to try to gather facts and maybe locate John during that period?
Not to locate John, but yes, he's a great lawyer with a good law firm, and he took the case and went right to work. So by the early part of 2002, he was able to dispatch a couple of private investigators from San Francisco. Essentially what they did...
And was that Barry Simon and David Fetchheimer?
Yeah, okay. You got their names.
Well,
they're great
guys. I knew that they had gone, but they wouldn't tell me why.
Oh, okay. Well, they went... Well, because they're probably not supposed to talk.
Yeah.
Anyway, they
yeah.
went and did a series of reports back to Mr. Brosnahan, John's lawyer. But yes, they went, and what they did was they retraced John's steps. They went to Yemen, they went to Pakistan, and they went to Afghanistan to the site of that massacre, and also out to that front line where John had been stationed. But by then, John, they weren't there to try to find John. By then, we knew the military had taken John down to Camp Rhino. After Camp Rhino, they took him to some Navy ships, the Bataan and the Peleliu. Mm-hmm. Two different ships where John was housed, along with a lot of other prisoners, in the Indian Ocean for this roughly 54-day period before they flew him back to the United States. So the investigators were not going to try to find John. Mm-hmm. The military told Brosnahan where John was. He was incommunicado, but we knew where he was. Mm-hmm. But they did retrace his steps and sort of verify John's story. John was able to tell them where he went, and they went and verified everything he told them.
Yeah. So... to kind of compress some of the events in 2002, Brosnahan takes the case, and his law firm says, you got to do this on your own because we don't want to be connected to a terrorist or to this alleged case of terrorism. So Brosnahan takes the case. You have this incredible air in the United States of fear, of loathing, of a kind of jingoism that I had never experienced before in my lifetime. So it's an incredibly toxic climate to seek justice. And they schedule John's trial to occur right around the first anniversary of 9/11. And again, he has been inaccurately described as somehow a participant in the plotting for 9/11. And so talk about the run up to the trial that never occurred because a plea bargain happened at the last minute. But as you were approaching the trial, what were your apprehensions, and what really led to the decision to take the plea bargain instead of trying the case?
Well, Peter, I don't think there's ever been a case quite like this in our history where all of these officials of the government, the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, the attorney general, even Senator Hillary Clinton, powerful politicians from both parties were on television repeatedly saying that John Lind was a terrorist and a traitor to the United States. He was being brought back as a criminal defendant, but he was already pronounced guilty by the high officials of our government. Even Charles Manson didn't suffer anything like that. And so it completely poisoned the atmosphere. There was no way John could get a fair trial. The Associated Press did a poll in 2002 of Americans, and it showed several things. First, everybody in America knew John Lind's name. It was universal. It was a household name. Second, everybody thought he was guilty. Nobody was quite sure what he was guilty of, but everybody knew he was guilty, and it all had to do with 9/11. There was a general sense, and you know, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, had quite deliberately said this, that John Lind was a traitor and an al-Qaeda terrorist who was involved with the 9/11 attacks. And so everybody more or less believed that. And so the polls showed that virtually 100% of Americans believed he was guilty before he was even brought to court. And the only difference was that Democrats thought he should get life in prison and Republicans thought he should be put to death. That was the debate, life in prison versus death. That was the only debate left. And nevertheless, into this toxic atmosphere, John's lawyers did an amazingly courageous job standing up for him, standing up for this kid, who really was, by the way, innocent.
Mm-hmm.
We have the presumption of innocence in our system, but this is a person who really was innocent, despite all these statements by the president and the others. The other thing, that if you don't mind adding some color to this, John was brought deliberately by the military back to the Dulles Airport outside of Washington in order to take him to court right by the Pentagon, one of the targets of the attack. And the jury pool in that area was very hostile to John. And the second thing I want to say is that within Washington at that time, other things were happening that contributed to this toxic atmosphere against John as a defendant. The anthrax poisonings were occurring. Someone mailed anthrax to Senate offices and other government offices in Washington, and it killed people in the old D.C. Central Post Office.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate office building, was completely sealed, had to be disinfected from this anthrax. So there was a sense that we're under attack from these mysterious sources. And then the third thing going on was the sniper. There was a sniper whose name was John Muhammad.
Yeah.
And he was going around the Washington, D.C. area with a young accomplice with a high-powered rifle and laying concealed in the back of his car, randomly killing people mm-hmm. as they went in shopping at Home Depot and places like that from a high-powered rifle.
And with his surname of Muhammad, there was this wrongful attitude that he was somehow a Muslim and that this was Islamic terrorism
that had surfaced. That's my point.
Yeah.
And, you know, we lived in the D.C. area for 11 years. John was born there, and he was 10 years old when he moved. So we all know the D.C. area quite well. And I have to say, as a person who had lived in D.C., and now I'm back in D.C. trying to help my son, the entire city, the entire Washington area, felt like it was under attack. Mm-hmm. Washington really was under attack. There was the Pentagon attack on 9/11, the anthrax attacks, and then this sniper that killed, I forget how many, but a bunch of people mm-hmm. around the Washington area. So it really felt like a city that was under siege.
And wasn't the Moussaoui trial in its early stages at that time?
Correct. Moussaoui was right there, housed in the same jailhouse as John.
Mm-hmm.
And he was called the 19th hijacker or 20th hijacker. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, the atmosphere, I have to say, was just unbelievably intolerant for John.
Mm-hmm. So we're proceeding to trial, and at what point did the government signal that they were prepared to offer a plea bargain?
Well, I'm not John's lawyer, mind you. I'm just his dad. He has lawyers, but here's what I know from them. It was July of 2002, they were going to have a hearing before the court with witnesses to talk about the mistreatment John had suffered by the military, the fact that he had been stripped naked and essentially tortured by the American military at the direction of Donald Rumsfeld at Camp Rhino. These facts were going to come out in the court. And the reason is because under our Fifth Amendment of our Constitution and under the Fourth Amendment, evidence that's seized by abusing a prisoner cannot be admitted in court. So John's lawyers filed what they called a motion to suppress. You cannot take any evidence from John after having put him through that ordeal. And the court had to hear that. And there was going to be witnesses. The military guys themselves were being called to court to testify from firsthand knowledge what John had suffered, what he had been through. Well, Secretary Rumsfeld did not want this torture evidence being displayed in a courtroom of the United States in the year 2002. Remember, this is before the invasion of Iraq, but these abuses had already begun to occur in John's case.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Feinstein later remarked about this, the fact that John was the first to be stripped naked and then put through these kinds of ordeals. So Rumsfeld was behind this, I'm quite sure, and the White House itself. So John's lawyers were approached by the prosecution lawyers, and the weekend before the hearing on the abuse, they struck a plea bargain. And they said, we will drop all the charges. Initially, John's lawyers told me, the prosecutors and the White House, it was really coming from the White House, insisted that John plead guilty to a charge of aiding al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And John, one thing about John is he's completely truthful. And he would not agree to it because it wasn't true. John did not support al-Qaeda. He had never heard of al-Qaeda. So then they backed away from that demand, and they let him plead guilty to a charge of assisting the Taliban government, which was the criminal violation there, was that the Taliban were not a terrorist organization. They were never listed as a terrorist organization, but there were economic sanctions in effect that prohibited private companies and private citizens from doing business with the Taliban government. And so John was guilty of violating the economic sanctions against the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
It's not terrorism at all. But for that one offense, John was forced to accept a 20-year prison sentence. And to this day, John remains a prisoner of the government.
Does that statute have a 20-year sentence, or was it just concocted?
Well, the whole thing was rather concocted, if you don't mind my saying so. But the statute has a 10-year sentence. John, by the way, was the only person ever prosecuted under this law.
Mm-hmm.
So he was singled out. But it had a 10-year sentence, and then they added a second 10-year sentence on top of the first because John was, quote, carrying a weapon when he committed this offense. Well, the weapon, John was a soldier in the Army, and as a soldier, he was issued a rifle and two hand grenades. That's what every infantryman would carry in the Army of Afghanistan.
So, and you stated in your article that he never fired that weapon.
No, he never did. He never fired his weapon, first point. And secondly, by the time John encountered any Americans in Afghanistan, he had long since surrendered.
He was a prisoner.
He was an unarmed prisoner.
Yeah.
But despite that, Secretary Rumsfeld, in one of his many, many press conference statements about John, told reporters that John Lind was found by American forces with an AK-47 in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine the prejudice that caused to John back here in America after 9/11. The suggestion that he was found by American troops with a weapon in his hands was really devastating.
Yeah.
As I've often said, that was not an honest mistake on the part of Secretary Rumsfeld. That was a deliberate misleading statement to inflame public passion against John.
So now that he's an inmate in a federal prison in Indiana, has John blended into the population, or is he still singled out for special abuse?
No, John's had a reasonably peaceful 10-11 years now of imprisonment in the federal prison system. But here's the thing. He's held in a special unit. I call it mini Guantanamo. He's in a special unit in Terre Haute, Indiana, of about 45 inmates. It's literally the old death row. Hmm. Where Timothy McVeigh was taken.
Mm-hmm.
They converted it, they moved death row to a new facility, and they converted the old facility into a special unit for Muslim inmates. There's a handful of non-Muslims, but for the most part, the 45 inmates in this special unit are all Muslims. And so I often say to John, you're living in a Muslim seminary now, or a monastery of Muslims. But it's a relatively benign environment. These mm-hmm. are not criminals. These are essentially, as far as I can ascertain, these are essentially sort of political prisoners. They are not guilty of any significant crimes. It's mm-hmm. a medium security facility, not high security. But he is among friends, so to speak. These are not criminals. And so he's not in any physical danger, and he's not harassed. They have, however, had a dispute with the prison officials about prayer. Prayer. The Muslim faith requires group prayer 5 times a day, and the warden declined. They used to allow it, and then for some reason they abruptly said they could not have group prayer. So John, I'm proud of him for this. He joined and then became the actual spokesman for the inmates in a lawsuit that went to trial last summer, and the federal judge earlier this year in Indianapolis found that John's case was meritorious, that the warden was obligated to allow the Muslims the right to pray 5 times a day in group prayer.
Did he handle that pro se?
No, he was represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, and I'm very grateful to them.
Uh-huh.
They did a great job.
So is John, trying to develop a track as a religious person? Does he want to be an imam? Does he want to be a teacher of Islam?
I think, yeah, if John were asked that question, I think he'd say, yes, I've always wanted to be a teacher. In fact, he's very scholarly. He uses the time in prison to continue his scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
He's really the most scholarly person I know in my life. He's very devoted to scholarship. He's reading these ancient Arabic transcripts and things like that. He's a learned person in the tradition of Islam. That's his aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And what does a learned person who's learned in the traditions of Islam do? Well, you become a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, has always been John's ambition. But mm-hmm. he did tell me a year or two ago that I'm doing what I expected to be doing at this point in my life, which is studying. I'm just in a place I wouldn't have expected to be in a prison.
So many federal prisoners are allowed email communications. Is John?
You know, it's funny you should ask, but I just got my first email from John about a week ago.
Oh, great.
So, yeah, he is allowed email. We do, by the way, though, we've always had visits and phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk every week, John and I, and his mom, she gets a call from him every week as well. And then
take a collect call at $5 a minute?
Mm. No, thankfully the federal system's better. I send John money, and then he uses money to pay for the calls.
Okay.
So I receive the call, and it says, you have a call from an inmate. Press 5 if you'll accept the call. So I accept, and we get 15 minutes a week on the phone, and then we visit. But when we visit, everything that we say is recorded by agents who sit in the other room. It's a little bit daunting, but we make the most of it.
Yeah.
We never get to touch him, though. That's the hard part. He's kept in a separate room, you know, through a glass, and we talk through a phone.
Yeah. And how often do you get to visit? Once or twice a year? Or?
3 or 4 or 5 times a year, depending. Yeah. And it's hard to get all the way to Indiana.
Yeah.
And we juggle Maryland. We stagger our visits. Maryland goes sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I go.
Mm-hmm.
In December, I got my other two kids, Connell and Naomi, and the three of us visited John's. We had all of us together. It was really great.
I also found online some poems that John has written under the name Abu Suleiman.
Yes, Suleiman was John's original. When you convert to Islam, you adopt a Muslim name, and Suleiman was his original name.
Mm-hmm.
But since he's been in prison with us and the family, he just goes by John,
yeah, you know,
or the Arabic version of John.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to link to some of his poems so listeners can read them. I was pretty impressed, and they have themes related to his experience, but they offer a point of view that I don't find has any self-pity. And this is one of the remarkable things, Frank, that I have seen. I've talked to a number of people who were at Guantanamo and have been released. I've talked to prisoners from San Quentin and in the state system here in California. And it's remarkable to me how a period of one's life can be taken through incarceration. And yet the humanity that emerges is often surprisingly intact and very forgiving. So what is John's attitude? Is he angry? Is he resentful? Or is he more or less accepting?
John is not oblivious to the fact that he has suffered a really grievous injustice. I mean, he's not guilty of any crime whatsoever, and yet he's been incarcerated for 20 years. And he was accused deliberately and in a false manner by the president and all these officials of crimes that he didn't commit. So he's not a fool. He understands that that was a grievous injustice. And yet, he's not bitter. He doesn't have bitterness. He has a great sense of humor. He takes things in stride. I think he takes the long view. I think he's confident that in the long run, people will come to understand that what happened here was an injustice. It was just a reaction to 9/11. And so just as you're saying, he's coming through this experience, and I expect he'll come out of prison when his term is finished with a kind of a positive outlook and without any sort of bitterness or recrimination or anything of that kind.
You also seem to be free of bitterness or anger. If I were in your position, I would not be as polite and diplomatic as you are about these issues.
Well, it's something, in a way, I've learned from John. You know, we can learn from our children as much as they learn from us. And I've learned that it would not help me to be bitter and angry and carry that around all the time. I've got to live through 20 years of my son being in prison. I am not going to, become bitter and dwell on that in a negative way. I try to think in a positive way. And also, let me say, Peter, that I think all of us in the family feel that we have a lot to be grateful for, despite the injustice that occurred here and the things that happened to John. He did survive, thank God. His spirit is intact. His psychology is intact. He's in good mental and physical health, despite everything that he went through. And he doesn't have that bitterness or anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a lot to be grateful for. I think of a lot of families who have lost their sons or their daughters in this ongoing war. John is alive, and he's well, and he's connected with his family. And in those respects, we have really quite a lot to be grateful for.
You've been a lawyer for over 25 years. You teach law.
Yes, I teach part-time. I work full-time, and I teach part-time.
Does this system work?
Well, it's hardly a perfect system. This case illustrates it. We have all these rights that we have, the right of the presumption of innocence, the right to be represented by a lawyer. These are the rights of a criminal defendant. These are really fundamental and important. The right not to be tortured is pretty darn important. The right not to have bad evidence brought into the courtroom and used as if it were good evidence. And yet the system is not perfect by far. And this is a case that illustrates how even an innocent person can be wrongly, falsely accused and then forced to accept a lengthy prison sentence. The government is a powerful enterprise. We have a constitution, but it's only as good as the people make it. I've often said to my law students, the Constitution does not live in a vault in the National Archives. That's where they keep it, but that's not where it lives. It lives in our hearts. When it dies there, forget it. And after 9/11, I have to say, Peter, in my direct experience as the father of John Lind, I have to say, I think we lost our Constitution. We lost our way for a while. I hope we're back. But there was definitely a period there in 2001, 2002, 2003, where the United States, I think, to a large extent, just walked away from its Constitution, betrayed the principles of our Constitution. And my son's case is an illustration of that. Detainee 001, his case, shows in a rather stark manner that really did happen.
Frank Lind, thanks for being here today. It's a real honor to talk with you and a pleasure to share John's story with my listeners.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this powerful account of a father who truly loves his son. I'd appreciate your comments. Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.